Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. What power do each of us have to care for a world in crisis? Viewed from the relative security of North Texas, the ongoing bloodshed in parts of Africa can seem like both a distant problem and one too large to be solved. But while ignoring human suffering may be the easiest thing to do, taking action to stop it can have a measurable impact on the lives of real human beings. John Prendergast is co-founder of the Enough Project, which works to end crimes against humanity, including genocide. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about what you have called the world's deadliest war. 5 million lives have been lost in Congo over the last decade, essentially because there is no functioning government. What are people fighting about?
You know, there are two layers of... None of these things are simple. You know, that's the first. And one of the reasons that has driven conflict in Congo, not just during the last decade, but for the last century, has been the insatiable demand for the things underneath the soil in Congo. There
minerals.
Are all kinds of minerals, non-petroleum. Maybe the richest natural resource base that doesn't involve petroleum in the entire world. So any one of us during a day may pick up items or use items, 5 or 10 items a day, that are directly linked back to the Congo. Our laptops, our iPods, our cell phones, and all kinds of different electronics products. Then, of course, there's gold and diamonds and other kinds of things that are mined from the Congo. So this extraordinary scramble for resources that involves both Congolese competing and warring factions who are fighting for control of the mines and the supply routes, but also then the outsiders, whether it's the first ring of neighboring countries who are looking to feed off the edges of this mineral export trade, and then all the way up to the multinational corporations that buy the minerals and use them in finalizing the products that we use on a daily basis.
And I guess the way many of these things are traded, it's not always apparent whether or not there's sort of blood on the products that we're buying. Are there a set of questions consumers can ask to make sure that they're not supporting this?
Sure, and that's really, you know, you look back a decade or decade and a half ago, and in the West African countries of Sierra Leone and Liberia, We all sort of vaguely remember this idea of blood diamonds, that the diamond trade was excavation was fueling wars in both of these two countries that were two of the bloodiest that the African continent had seen in the last century. And over time, campaigners, human rights activists and others, began to target some of the big diamond sellers and explaining to consumers that when they bought these diamonds, it very well could be diamonds that were fueling conflict, fueling some terrible human rights abuses. So over time, the industry itself, led by the biggest diamond seller, De Beers, decided this public relations problem is too great for us, and we're going to have to regulate this industry and create some kind of a certification scheme where the diamonds that are coming from these illegitimate areas mined by the warring parties, we're just not going to buy them anymore. And so a similar kind of effort needs to be mounted now, and that's where there's all kinds of discussions going on now in Washington and other capitals around the world between human rights groups to figure out how can we do the same kind of thing that we did for the diamonds in West Africa for some of these minerals. Some of them harder to pronounce and understand or even to explain what they actually do inside our cell phones and inside our laptops, but they're nevertheless essential components of these electronic products, to do the same kind of campaigning with the big computer companies and the various electronics end users that are selling the products to us. So it's going to require that kind of a campaign, and we're just now figuring out the details of what it's going to look like before it's launched over the course of the next year.
This problem, of course, is not exclusive to conflict in Africa, but it does seem that sexual violence against women is used often as a tool of war. Can you talk about the ways that women can be protected when they live in these places?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And Congo is the most extreme case. You know, I think we've seen in Bosnia and in Rwanda and other places where rape has been used as a tool of war, violence against women, as a means to humiliate and subjugate groups of people that the warring parties want to humiliate. And so the Congolese militias are taking it to a new level. The Congo is now considered to be the most dangerous place in the world to be a woman. And my fear is that if it's left unaddressed, if other warring parties around the world and other militias and other governments that use repressive tactics for their various purposes, if others see how effective this tool has been as a war strategy, they will replicate it and multiply it all across the earth. And I fear that if we don't very aggressively do what you're saying, protect people, demonstrate that there is some kind of a cost, some accountability for committing these kinds of crimes, then left unchecked, they're going to spread like a virus. So the real answer is some measure of direct accountability for the leaders of these militias that are conducting these kinds of horrible abuses. And that's where the body that has been charged now for the last 6 years, set up in 2002, first time ever in the world, we have an international entity that tries people for war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide called the International Criminal Court. The United States government hasn't signed on to the treaty, but has supported some of the specific investigations and prosecutions. So the time has come now for the ICC to begin to look at violence against women as one of its central, because again, if this is allowed to fester, it'll spread like wildfire.
China has quite openly formed alliances with some really despotic governments, notably Zimbabwe and Sudan, and yet China now holds the presidency of the UN Security Council. What kinds of pressure can we place on China from within this country that would at least push it toward international standards of human rights?
Yeah, well, we had a great opportunity, we have to be honest, you know, during these Olympics, where it was a huge coming out party for the Chinese government. They wanted to present a new face to the world. And the idea of many human rights activists for a variety of issues, Tibet and Burma and Darfur, environmental standards, labor practices, all kinds of issues, had the idea that when the Chinese government would come out with their new face to the world, that there would be a corresponding effort to try to attach some of the footnotes, like, by the way, this is what the Chinese government is really doing. Globally. But it frankly did not succeed. The Chinese, I think, had a fairly successful hosting of the Olympics. And it turns out that the shaming strategy, you know, that the full frontal assault of the human rights community trying to change China's behavior on the basis of naming and shaming, it didn't work. And so we have to look more. It doesn't mean we don't continue and continue to press and push. We also have to look at China's self-interest. So you take a case like Sudan, where they have invested $8 billion in the Sudanese oil sector. And if the war continues in Darfur and spreads, the first target of that spreading will be the Chinese oil installation. So they actually have a vested interest, a national security interest in peace in Sudan, but they haven't yet recognized it and then taken the kind of actions that need to be taken to help bring it about. So I think the new president, whoever is elected in November, one of the first things we can do is send an envoy to Beijing to talk about some of the common interest that we have in a continent like Africa. Now, we have a lot of differences. We disagree on human rights. We disagree on labor issues, standards, and all kinds of things. But we might have some things where we can actually work together on. And we should start working together in those areas while we continue to work on them to try to change their behaviors, their approaches to the conduct of international relations and some of their own standards at home. But in the meantime, I think we, the United States and China, can work very closely together to solve some of these problems because of the long-term economic interest that China has in peace and stability and the interest that the United States has in promoting peace and security for the people of Africa.
I want to talk about people who are displaced by conflict. There are millions of them throughout Africa. What goes into the current thinking when decisions are being made about whether to try and keep people, at least in their country of origin, during a conflict, or pull them completely out at the risk of disrupting them culturally and socially to get them out of harm's way?
You know, I think that we think that we have a lot of influence on that process, but people go where they feel safe. People go where they can get assistance. So, for example, in a particular case where the situation inside a country is very, very dangerous and it's hard to get humanitarian assistance into those displaced camps inside the country, people will migrate with their feet. They'll vote with their feet and leave. And whatever we might want to try to do by issuing press statements or trying to draw people in with little extra bits of humanitarian assistance, I mean, it's just not going to fool anyone. They know better than anyone where they can go, where they can be safe, or at least be safest, because often they're not safe. They just got to find different levels of insecurity and try to find the least insecure areas and try to find those little pockets, those oases of stability that they can hide in the context of civil conflict or interstate war. So it's usually the case where people just decide on the basis of the information that they have on the ground, where can I go best to protect my family or the remaining members of my family, and then they go there. And we have done very poorly, I think, as an international community at protecting people in these kinds of crises. It probably is the great failure of the 20th century is to figure out mechanisms and means to protect people in the context of conflict. We send hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in humanitarian assistance, and sometimes billions of dollars in support for peacekeeping forces, which end up being observer forces who just take notes and file reports back to the United Nations Security Council. Very little effort is expended on actually protecting the refugee and displaced populations who have been uprooted by the conflicts or the villages that have yet to be burned in some of these places. We do very, very little about that, mostly because the forces that we'll send in, coming from countries like Uruguay and Botswana and Nepal and India, these countries won't send their forces in these multinational peacekeeping operations if they're going to go in and start fighting a war, protecting people, because it's sometimes you have to shoot back. And
we don't either. The United States sends
the
cash
US
and not troops.
No. We don't get involved in most of these places. That we definitely are the primary funder of multinational peacekeeping operations through the United Nations, but very rarely do we actually send large-scale troop contingents. We usually keep them out and use them for our own, Iraq and Afghanistan being Exhibit A and B. In which the kind of efforts we'll take, but for all the forgotten wars and the peacekeeping and peace enforcement operations, the U.S. and most of the big European armies stay out of these.
So, are we following through on what we claim are our values of promoting and protecting democracy around the world if we send money there, but not troops the way we've sent them to other places?
I think if you hosted this show in most of the rest of the world and you brought up the D word, democracy, and then the United States and put those in the same sentence, people would roll their eyes. I think we have a great deal of sanctimoniousness about the rightness of our approach, and then we take the cookie cutter and we stamp it down on country after country, pushing the electoral processes that we have, and the results are highly erratic. The real investment in democracy, with a small d, that countries around the world appreciate is when you invest in the local media, the local civil society groups, the building up the networks of opposition political parties, so that you can create and nurture cultures of peaceful disagreement and debate, and instead of fast forwarding to the big enchilada of the election. And so I think we've really done a disservice to many countries by our high-profile megaphone diplomacy, you know, shouting at countries and telling them what they're hectoring them and what they ought to be doing, but having very few resources for the real state building and nation building that must be a prerequisite for electoral processes to function effectively.
So in the few seconds that we have left, what do we learn from countries like South Africa and Mozambique and even Rwanda that really have turned around in the past few years?
Thank you for asking, because, you know, we often think of Africa as a terrible basket case, you know, a hopeless continent. But the truth is you have all these extraordinary case studies of countries that were mired in conflict and were perceived to be hopeless places and have turned themselves around with a little help from the outside. You know, the United States can play an incredibly important role with some positive diplomacy, with a little bit of assistance, and they are peaceful, functioning democracies. Sierra Leone and Liberia, the countries we talked about with the Blood Diamonds and the ones you mentioned, and everybody knows the story of Nelson Mandela. He'd still be in prison today if there wasn't a mass movement of people here in the United States and in Europe who pressed and pushed for the end of this terrible system called apartheid. So there are great, great success stories out there, and I'm glad you asked about them, because they would give people hope that the places like Darfur and Congo can one day turn around.
John, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you
for
having me.
You can learn more about John's work at enoughproject.org. Just ahead on Think, North Texas students learn to mine the academic benefits of visual art. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes hallowed artifacts, a harrowing drama, and Halloween happiness. For the scaredy cats of all ages, make your way to the Fort Worth Zoo for the first weekend of the 17th annual Boo at the Zoo, a six-day spooktacular featuring the return of the Drummond Monkeys and the musical hit Monster Mash. If you haven't already, head to the DMA for the mind-blowing and expansive Tutankhamun and the Golden Age of the Pharaohs, featuring over 130 rarely seen artifacts, several never seen outside of Egypt. In keeping with the spirit of Tut, the Dallas Children's Theater travels to the Valley of the Nile for the Python-esque mystery spoof, The Mummy's Claw. And on stage at the Stone Cottage Theater in Addison, come out for Mark Brian Sana's brutal psychological thriller, Dream Awake, tackling the themes of faulty recollection and false memory, and directed by Alejandro Da Costa. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
What can art do for your brain? The National College Board finds that students with art education tend to outscore their peers on standardized tests, which comes as little surprise to the folks working with the Dallas Contemporary. Education Coordinator Diane Sykes is here to talk about ArtThink, which last year served more than 5,000 students in 40 Dallas schools. Diane, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So what is ArtThink and how does it work?
ArtThink is a 7-week program where 6 weeks we go into different classrooms, whether it be a traditional DISD classroom or an after-school program, and we show contemporary art images. We ask the students open-ended questions like what's going on in the image and have them work together to construct meaning.
And so I guess part of it is just getting them to look sort of critically at what it is they're seeing.
Definitely. The first couple minutes of each session, we have them stare and sort of process their thoughts, and then also do a little sketching. And we try to really reinforce that we're not making artwork that we're going to hang on the wall. It's like visual note-taking. So they're very actively engaged.
Yeah, it seems like when a lot of people my age think back to what art was when they were kids, they think about making almost a craft. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what you're working on.
Not at all. And it's very surprising when we first start the program with the school, because they think that we're going to come in with lots of art supplies, and it's really very minimal. We have a projector and journals.
So what explains, do you think, the link between higher test scores in things like math and reading and studying visual art?
I think art is about problem solving and thinking creatively. And it's important to art, but it's also important in other factions of your life. And I think art is sort of an entryway into that kind of thinking.
How different are children and teenagers when they're talking about the art that they've seen as opposed to adults?
Children and high school students are a lot less they're a lot freer with their thoughts than adults. I think adults look at contemporary art especially and feel like it's outside of them, that they can't really...
if it's not representational art, I know a lot of adults feel like if they don't solve the mystery of what they're supposed to understand about it, then they don't connect to it.
Right. And they've been told so many times that contemporary art is conceptual, it's abstract, it's, if you're not the artist, you can't understand it. And kids really haven't been told that yet, so they're a lot more open to the possibilities.
One of the things I know that you guys have done over the past couple of years is you've published this journal that you give to every student. What does that do for them?
It's like their own journal that they can record their thoughts, they can experiment with, you know, different drawing techniques. It's not something that is going to be on display. It really is like their own...
A record, maybe, of what they're experiencing?
Yeah, and it becomes really important to them over the 6 weeks because as we go through the program, they become a lot more open to new media, and so they're also breaking down barriers within their own heads, and they record it in this book.
What makes a gallery or a museum particularly kid-friendly or family-friendly?
I think after students go through this program, they feel like they have a little ownership of the art, and so we try to use that same open-ended process with them, so we don't bring them into the museum and then become the authority. Like, we still want their input and want to have the discussion with them. And I think it makes it a lot more approachable and a lot more accessible.
Do you sort of tell them that there are specific things to look for when they're first encountering a piece?
We really started out with asking them what they think is going on. So we try to make them dig a little deeper than just listing what they see, mm-hmm. but having them start to construct maybe a narrative or a story. And then from what they say, we rephrase back what they're saying, and we kind of insert some of the vocabulary, which leads to here's some main ideas within the artwork.
Yeah, so you give them the language to talk about it.
Right.
Last thing I want to ask you is what parents whose kids maybe aren't in this program can do to give their children the same sorts of benefits.
I think really using these strategies of asking open-ended questions and then following it up with what do you see that tells you that, like trying to get them to push a little further and to find evidence to what they're seeing, it really helps them to understand what they see and helps them think more critically. And parents can do that on their own looking at art.
Sounds great. Diane, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You can learn more about ArtThink at thecontemporary.net. The Think page of KERA's website offers free video and audio podcasts of this show, and you can send email anytime to think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.